Whoa. That was unexpected. Yes. That was surprise and delight.
Bless you. I apologize.
Greetings, friends, and welcome to PC Gamer Podcast number 218. It is the 9th day of April, and I am your host, Josh Augustine. Riding by my side, as always, into the perilous battle that is podcasting, Editor-in-Chief, Logan Decker.
Hello.
That was my Kimberly editor. Voice.
That was not cute and furry at all. That was, like, gruff. That's like back alley gibberling trying to mug for your kidney or something.
Well, they do exist.
They do.
Gibberlings.
Reviews editor Dan Stapleton.
Hi, everybody. Nor am I cute and fuzzy sounding. I actually take pride in that.
But who will be cute and sounding, or cute and fuzzy sounding, but senior editor Evan Lottie?
I've got to disappoint you. I'm going to use my introduction to mention that Arma 2 is $30 on Impulse this weekend. Go buy it.
I will allow it, but I'm not happy about that intro.
Still sounded fuzzy to me.
What's fuzzier than hardcore simulation?
Exactly.
Stimulation. Executives. Wait, let me. I messed that up. Hold on. Executive Senior Supreme Dictator Intern Eric Belsas.
You know, I could really get used to that title.
It's still totally meaningless. Bottom of the totem pole.
For now.
But it sounds awesome.
Until we get our new intern.
And we have gotten a bunch of applications, so now we're gonna be sorting through those.
Are we done accepting applications?
Nah, you know,
we're never done accepting applications. You could always be hit by a car. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
we have to take this into account.
Good to know you have like an insurance plan there, Logan.
Yeah, we receive money if you get taken out.
That's awesome. That's a good idea, actually.
I just watched Evan make an awesome crush the castle shot over his shoulder here. This was in our 50 games to play at work feature.
Oh my god, yeah, he was doing that on the plane too.
There he goes, King's dead. Yeah, armorgames.com. Check it out.
And podcast master blaster Andy Bauman.
Hey guys.
Whoa, that was a lot of
words. Mr. Radio voice.
that was a master blast.
Yeah, I had nowhere else to go besides Radio Land.
Hey, it works. I like it.
All right.
So let's get into the awesome, exciting news this week. So between like collector's editions, game launches, top secret previews, and spoilers, you know, we've had a lot of news this week, but we went the extra mile, and on top of all that, acquired an awesome interview with Marcin Iwiński, the co-founder and joint CEO of CD Projekt and GOG.com. So yeah, so let's go ahead and get straight into that interview. We're here with Marcin Iwiński, co-founder and joint CEO of CD Projekt, obviously, you know, with GOG.com. So, Marcin, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks a lot.
Nice. So what can you tell us about what's going over at GOG? What's new over there nowadays?
There's plenty of things going on at GOG. So February was a major month for us and a great kickstart for the year because we've announced our partnership with Activision and we've launched the first batch of their titles. And then 2 weeks ago at our conference, we've announced an ex-major partner joining GOG.com, which is Atari. So we're still preparing the titles, going through the approval process, but in April we'll start releasing all the good, or should I even say great, Atari titles.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, how has publisher response been kind of overall? It seems like you guys are starting to get picking up even more steam.
Yeah, I mean, you know, from at the very beginning, it was tough. Obviously, we're approaching publishers and telling them, hey, you know, we are these guys from Eastern Europe and we have an idea about a service for all their games, which will be DRM-free with the same price all around the world. games available worldwide. And a lot of them were saying initially, hey, but that's not the industry standard. That's not what people are doing around. So why don't you do a normal platform like the other guys are doing, like make a DRM one and then regionalize the pricing. But we've managed to convince initially Interplay with their great catalog, then Codemasters, and we've taken from there. So I can say that right now it's definitely easier as people see that this business model works, that there are revenues generated for publishers. What was initially our pitch, but you know, when we're just walking around with the PowerPoint presentations, we didn't have many proofs. I think very helpful here was the fact that we are in the business for 15 years already. As I started this original company, the Setup Project company, with some, my friend from high school, Michal, and the first business we started, which is still a big business for us, and it's running here in Eastern Europe. It's the publishing and distribution business in Poland. So we are basically republishing and distributing a lot of the games which are now released on GOG.com. Obviously, 15 years ago, they were brand new ones. They were big releases for us. And we had a lot of contacts, and I think we gained a lot of credibility. So this definitely helped to kickstart GOG.com. But then, you know, it was really showing that the business model works and that there is a lot of happy gamers. I mean, a lot of publishers and developers, because we are also signing content from developers, are very pleased with that.
Yeah. So how is business? I know you can't talk about sales numbers specifically or anything like that, but are you pretty pleased with the numbers that you're seeing nowadays?
Yes, we are actually. funny enough, because when we were starting the whole project, we were thinking like, so, how can we model the business? How can we just have, you know, an idea of an estimation of what units can be sold? So we're really looking at the budget ranges we're doing in retail in Eastern Europe. They're very popular. We are selling really millions of old PC games. Still, I mean, the market here, especially Poland, Russia, it's pretty much PC driven. The consoles are a small part of it. So it's really the mass market. And we looked at the success of the budget ranges and we thought, okay, let's say we'll apply this number somehow to GOG.com. And then, you know, we've made some simulations. The estimations were very careful. And actually, we were surprised with the popularity and with the success. I think there was a lot of goodwill and a lot of support from the gamers, because initially, you know, we were a totally unknown place. Yes. I mean, why should you buy at that totally new platform? Nobody knew about us.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons I always liked GOG was your DRM-free policy. Do you have any idea how much piracy has kind of hurt in that regard, or how not having the DRM has helped overall?
I mean, it's pretty hard to say. I can just say what we see when we look around. Funny enough, sometime after launching GOG.com, we've seen comments on the torrent sites of actually the pirates saying, hey, I mean, GOG has such a fair offer that will not pirate their games. We really like that. And obviously, you know, the older games are not, I would say, that extremely attractive to for the pirates. The piracy is still pretty much about the really, really new stuff. I don't think it's really hurting our business a lot. There's a lot of value in what we are offering, and the price points are low. So at the current stage, I would say that piracy it's really not a big issue. And you know, there will always be people who think that it's not even worth to pay $6 for a game with, I don't know, additional materials and great community and stuff and DRM free, yeah, which you can download as many times as you want. But then, you know, you can help that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's really good to hear. We definitely love your guys' policy on that. So what's your guys' top seller right now?
I mean, top seller, you can look it up at GOG, but if you're looking at the all-time top sellers, you know, these are definitely the first game we started with, which are the Interplay titles, because there were the longest time on site. So definitely the Fallouts, Fallout 1, Fallout 2. Then I'll say Duke Nukem, Heroes of Might and Magic. So the games, you know, the games everybody knows and everybody wants to play.
Nice. So those are the best selling, but
yeah.
What do you like to play best? What's your favorite game that you have online there?
Fallout. I'm a huge Fallout fan, and that was the first deal we made. You know, like when we planned GOG, I said, you know, we have to have Interplay first, and we are lucky enough to convince them and sign it up. I was really happy to have Fallout, and I think a lot of people we're very pleased with the fact we have all the Fallouts up there. These are really cult games. It's funny because when I'm thinking about Fallout, and I think this is the case with a lot of gamers that were brought up with the likes of Fallout or Duke Nukem, we sort of we have a very idealistic view of the game or imagination of the game in our minds. And then we start playing it, and the first contact is like, but it's low res and it's not 3D rendered. It's not like a new X360 game. But then after 10, 15 minutes of playing, you're really playing in your imagination. That's incredible. That's actually my experience with Fallout. I really love it.
Yeah, it's almost kind of you're just enjoying the nostalgia feel that you get from playing it rather than necessarily enjoying the game a second time.
The thing is, especially with RPG games, I'm a huge fan of RPG games. You don't need the modern graphics that much because it's the story. Yeah, this is actually getting more tricky with the racing games or the sport games. There's not that many of them on GOG.com, but we released some time ago a game VR Soccer, which in Europe was actual soccer, and. Yeah, there's not many people willing to play a 10-year-old soccer game, you know?
Yeah, there's some limits to that, obviously. So what do you consider kind of the cutoff to be for a game to be old, considered old?
Yeah, it's a tough one. How old is old? I think we're really talking about 5 years plus. Sometimes it's newer, but really 4 or 5 years and older. And then, most of all, good. I mean, it's about good games, good old games, and there must be good. Really, there's nobody that's interested in bad old games, you know.
Oh, yeah. So how much effort do you have to kind of put into refining these older games, but updating the older games to run on, like, Windows 7 64-bit?
Yeah, actually, you know, the Windows we haven't officially announced we guarantee Windows 7 compatibility. I mean, we do our best, and this is the next step for us. And our QA lab, our retro QA lab is spending a lot of time on it. Generally, you know, it's really case by case. Sometimes even not that old games, like a 4-year-old game, has a problem to work on the current system. And I would say the easiest cases is they are just running. We are, of course, playing through the games on all the systems. So all the XP Vista right now, also Win7, both 32 and 64-bit modes. But then there are cases which are actually the not release cases, although we've signed them a couple months ago, that we are working on and we still can't get them working. So it's anything from 1 day to 3 months, I would say, to get these games running. It's really, it really depends how old is the game, how it was written. And, you know, obviously when somebody was writing an XP game, they were never thinking that there would be people willing to run it on Vista.
Yeah. So do you have any, so what's like the hardest game that you've had to deal with trying to compatibility issues?
The hardest ones are the ones we have not released yet. So they are still in the lab. But okay, yeah, I have a good one for you. It's the Ishar. These are, I think there's a couple of them in one pack, but this is like extreme retro. And I've never played these games when they're originally released, but a lot of people at GOG did, and they said, wow, it's cool, and you know.
Who was it that made Ishar?
You know, I have to, yeah, let me check it out on the website, actually, because as I told you, I've never played them when they were originally released. We signed it from a French company, Ishar. Yeah, we have the Ishar compilation, and it's from it's from Silmarils. It's European. It's from France, and I think we spent a couple months on it.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you look at the screenshots, that's real retro stuff.
Yeah, it looks like an old school RPG game.
Yeah. Old school French RPG game. Not working on any system. Out of the box. Yeah.
It came out in 1994. I mean, that's 16 years. That's a long time.
Yeah, but then you know, there are some games from 94 which were working out of the box practically. Mm-hmm. So it's really up to the way the games were written.
Yeah. So kind of back to the customers. Do you know if GOG sees a lot of kind of small number of people buying a lot of games, or if it's a lot of people, you know, maybe buying just a few games here or there?
I mean, I can tell you how the trend was changing, because the user base is obviously growing, and I think, you know, people really like what we're doing, so they're recommending it to their friends. So usually it starts with one game, and then initially we had the user base and the user base is still there. That's why GOG, it's GOG. We have a hardcore fan base, and they have like almost all of the games we have released. That there are people who actually bought every single game on GOG. This is a small group, but it's very active. It's very active in the community. But right now we have a big group of people who just heard GOG, it's cool, or it's a good way to play, and they're coming buying one game, and then they're buying another one, a promotion. So I think we are going much wider with GOG right now. Also, you know, some of the games, yes, I mean, if you look at the screenshots from Isha or even from King's Quest, this is retro, and you must be a fan. You must know these games to go and buy them and then enjoy them. But there are games which look really cool. I don't know, Siberia series, which was just released, for example, or the 15th anniversary edition of Another World. They look really cool, and they appeal to a much wider group of people.
Yeah. All right. So kind of jumping out of GOG, with Witcher 2, kind of. What exactly are you working on that?
Yeah, we're working on a great RPG, you know, a true RPG, dark RPG, based on obviously on the world created in the books by Andrzej Sapkowski. So it's pretty much a continuation of the story of Witcher 1, but we've developed
specifically, like, what's your role on the project? Sorry about that.
My role, I'm I'm the guy who's signing the deals, so I'm on the business side.
Okay.
I'm of the business side of things, and I'm on the board of the company, but I'm still pretty much involved. I'm not involved in the creative part, but I'm involved in the project.
So, kind of what you've seen of Witcher 2 so far, what are you most excited about?
Trees. The sorceress. yeah. The naked trees, you know. That's what I'm most excited about. Yeah, but seriously, the story. And, I think it's, you know, I really love what I saw, and the devs, didn't want to show me a lot much earlier because it wasn't finished. So I've seen just, you know, bits and pieces. But then when I saw the last version, the slice, that was presented around and that was based for the trailer, I was really blown away. It's different when you put, you know, all the assets together and you have, the proper voice acting, you know, the mimics works, and you have a more or less a polished piece of game. this is much different experience than when you're looking at stuff which is, you know, deep in development. This doesn't work, that doesn't work. Sometimes you have to really use your imagination. If you're not in the project on a daily basis, it's quite hard. But what I wanted to say that probably the most exciting thing for me in The Witcher is the story. And I actually had long conversations with our project lead when we were traveling around. And he was telling me the story, and the story is amazing. I mean, I loved the story for The Witcher 1. I obviously read all the books by Andrzej Sapkowski, and I love this kind of dark, very mature fantasy literature, which is actually, I would say, contemporary world, but in the more like Tolkien's settings, and there are elves, dwarves, but really the all the problems that the books are touching, and then we are trying to serve it in the game in a similar way. It's about a real breeding world with the contemporary problems which you're facing in your life. Maybe not as a professional monster slayer, but yes. So I'm really excited about the story.
Very cool. How did The Witcher do in the U.S. relative to Europe?
I mean, it did. I think it did well. You know, it's always a tough question when you are coming out with your first game. So we didn't have the experience. Actually, to be very honest, our biggest, maybe not challenge, but the thing the biggest fear we had was that the game will be too European, or should I even say too Eastern European, to be successful in the US. Because it's if you look at the PC games that are coming from Europe, even look at Germany, the big RPGs, look at the Gothic series, look even at the Divine Divinity stuff. These games were not really commercially successful in the US. And if you look at reviews of Gothic series, they usually starting like, wow, the interface is bad. This is bad. I just can't play it. Thank you. While in Europe, I mean, in Germany, these games are the games, are the best RPGs. They're massively selling hundreds of thousands of units. But actually, if you look at Eastern Europe, Poland and Russia, these games are selling many thousands of units. Actually, we're selling Gothic 3. I think we sold 40 or 50,000 in Poland alone. And these games, I mean, gamers are much more tolerant, I would say, to the hardcore elements. So maybe the interface in Gothic is awkward, but then the game is so cool that people will just learn the interface and they'll forget it after, you know, 30 minutes of playing. Well, indeed, what we notice in the US, it's very different. That the experience must be really great out of the box, and people don't tolerate, you know, really not finished stuff, or, you know, that something is not up to the standard of controls or anything. And we spent a lot of time on it. So I think at the end, we were very happy.
Really looking forward to seeing how Witcher 2 turns out, and always excited about the new new games coming to GOG every week, it seems like. So best of luck with that. Thank you again for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you very much. It was great talking to you guys. And, you know, do visit GOG. There's plenty of old games to be released there. So
definitely looking forward to it.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
All right.
Thank you very much, Martin.
So we've had some exciting news this week. I don't know, does anyone have super passionate feelings about where we should start off? I mean, we got the StarCraft 2 play. All right. So I'm going to start the news over then.
Just keep going, baby.
All right. We're keeping the tapes rolling. This is PC Gamer Live. So we got the StarCraft 2 Collector's Edition was announced today. It's $100. It comes with a lot of extras, including but not limited to a book, a flash drive with the original two games on it, or the original game and expansion, behind-the-scenes DVD, a comic book, soundtrack, and of course a World of Warcraft in-game pet for the Thor robot. It's $100. I don't know, how do you guys feel in general about Collector's Editions?
Me personally, I never really elect to buy a collector's edition. I'm pretty much just in it for the game. All the extra stuff is largely clutter, and you know that's coming from a guy with a whole field of like action figures in front of him right now. But it just, you know, I don't really have a whole lot of room for that stuff. Like, I feel like it builds up and builds up, and I never want to throw any of it away, especially when I pay for it, pay extra for it.
Yeah.
So I just kind of want the game. What about you guys?
Yeah, I went through a definite CE phase where I was like, I gotta have every collector's edition I can possibly find. And then I realized I wasn't even watching the behind the scenes DVDs after a while. I lost my Half-Life 2 ball cap that came with my $100 version of that. And then I decided that the collector's editions just weren't for me. But I've got a question. Does this collector's edition, does this guarantee you the next two StarCraft 2 campaigns, or is this just the first campaign?
This is just the first campaign.
Okay. Yeah, this is Wings of Liberty.
Alrighty then.
Yeah, and so they still haven't announced exactly how they're going to treat the next two campaigns, whether they will be standalone or expansions or what. So we're not sure how that's going to pan out yet.
Yes, I know. Eric, Logan, because I like collector's editions. I'm kind of a sucker for the behind the scenes kind of DVDs, kind of seeing what went into the process, what it looked like before it was final. I don't know. And of course the WoW pet. I mean, if it comes with a code, that thing is going to be worth so much money on eBay. But I'm guessing it's just going to be linked to your battle.net account. So people that are thinking about buying the collector's edition to sell the WoW pet code probably won't happen. So I wouldn't really take the risk on that. Oh, I'm sure it will, because if everything's linked to the battle.net account. And so if you register the collector's edition, I imagine it'll be just like if you have an authenticator linked to your account, you get a special pet in WoW. I think it'll just be automatically added to your characters.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Yeah, I think it really bothers them that their stuff sells for, you know, hundreds or thousands of dollars on eBay. I bet they're looking for ways to kind of make sure that doesn't happen with this.
Oh yeah, did you see I sent you the link to the WoW original World of Warcraft collector's edition box that sold for like, what was it, $1,200 on eBay?
Yes.
This last week.
$1,200. That is insane.
Absurd. And like I've seen WoW pets go, like codes for pets going for as much as like $2,000 on eBay. It's ridiculous.
Blizzard's like, we got this laying around. I mean, you want to come down and get one? Come get one.
Yeah, so I guess if this, you could look at this as an investment. You buy it for $100 now, in 5 years, sell it for three times as much.
Yeah. I usually don't like collector's editions, generally because, you know, a lot of this stuff seems kind of cheesy to me, But I love the stuff that they do sell, not necessarily with a collector's edition. You know, like I just got my Machinarium yellow vinyl disc that I ordered from, you know, from Prague. And it's just fantastic. The cover's beautiful, you know, the vinyl's beautiful. And all the stuff that came with the BioShock 2 collector's edition is awesome. You know, the art book is awesome. The vinyl record is awesome. Yeah, it came with the soundtrack on vinyl and on CD. The only thing it didn't have was like a big hypodermic needle full of Atom, you know?
But I mean, for me, like, aside from like the action figure or whatever, I don't have a turntable. I don't want one. So that vinyl thing would be junk. In order to listen to the CD, I would rip it. And then the physical CD is just clutter. You know, it's just like a bunch of stuff.
Yeah. Don't you think that life is just a bunch of stuff? I mean, aren't our entire lives just a bunch of stuff?
Yeah, I forgot we're in America.
but you know, I guess that's kind of what Blizzard is going for, a grab bag of digital and hard things. I definitely think the you know, Brood War and the original StarCraft on a USB cable. You're saying earlier, Dan. If you can run that off the CD key, that's.
DVD or the flash drive
the one of those things. If you can run the game off that, just purchasing that as an idea, you know, knowing that you can do that at any time is a fantastic feat.
Yeah, I mean that's one part of this package that really caught my eye. It's a 2 gigabyte like custom built flash drive, you know, so it's supposed to look like Jim Rayner's dog tags. So that's kind of cool. So. But on there it has the original StarCraft and the Brood War expansion. So I'm not exactly sure in what condition those games are at that point. I mean, like if they've had any like GOG style work done on them to make sure that they're compatible with modern systems, because there is some tweaking that you have to do to make it work well on a modern system. You know, make sure that it runs well. And if I can just plug that into any computer anywhere and launch the game off of the flash drive, then that's worth something right there.
I agree. So it sounds like, you know, overall, you know, we could be convinced to buy collector's edition, but it takes something kind of above and beyond, you know, just a extra little bonus item or something to get us to buy it.
But it is $100.
$100, but the game is going to be $60, the regular version. So I mean, it's only a $40 upgrade.
Right. Yeah. The Activision is implementing their $60 thing across the board with all their popular stuff. It looks like it's finally happening.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's kind of a bummer, but not unexpected. So.
Yeah, and you know, when you think about it, as we've discussed in the past, the inflation, you know, accounting for inflation, you're still paying less for this than you did for a $50 game 10 years ago.
I mean, it would take a lot to get me. You know, I'm a big cheapskate as anybody, but it takes a lot to get me to the point where I'm really going to groan compared to like the experience of a movie, that's in 3D and is invariably crappy and only lasts 2 hours at best.
Right.
And who are the blue people?
in this case, they're the Protoss.
it's really not the end of the world. I mean, what the end of the world would be is charging $60 if it's just a campaign for the Zerg in the next edition. If it's simply the campaign for the Protoss in the next edition after that.
Yeah, you know, I don't see them charging the same amount. And you know, this is perhaps me being optimistic, but I don't see them charging $60 for the next two pieces simply because the next two pieces, even if they're a standalone expansion, so they would, you know, have like everything you need to play, like the Protoss campaign and the multiplayer, they still aren't going to make you, they're not going to fracture their multiplayer community, I don't think. So they would want you to have, they would want people who have Wings of Liberty to be able to play with the people that have the next expansion. So they're not going to, so it's basically, if you buy the first and then buy the second, you're not getting the multiplayer all over again, so you're not getting the same value. So I expect that. I would be disappointed in Blizzard if they were to charge $60 for that as well.
Yeah, that'd be silly. I mean, especially with, I just really hope they don't divide like maps or anything like that through Battle.net. We've already seen like in the beta, you can download maps very easily. That sort of system is going to be applied to user created maps and content. So yeah, that would be bizarre and then very not PC.
Yeah, I mean, they did historically divide their community by releasing Brood War. So it's not impossible that they'll do it. But I tend to think that you know, having them look back at history, that they might think better of that.
So to get the rest of the Blizzard news out of the way, so we can just kind of focus on non-Blizzard stuff, because Blizzard does have a lot of exciting stuff coming out. They started releasing class information for Cataclysm this week. Also, there's going to be... there's rumors that the beta will be opening up in like maybe a month or two, opening up to players because it's opening up to press fairly soon, within a few weeks. So they're starting to release a lot of information, I think, before it gets leaked out anyways.
Of course, this is all, you know, Blizzard time, so it could all push back, you know, several months on a whim.
Yes, exactly. Weeks are relative. so far they're basically doing three class updates a day. And technically, they got their third in last night, the Priest one, at 11:58 p.m. on the forums, which is kind of a weird move because you had people on the East Coast staying up, and then they finally went to bed at maybe like 11:45 because they just gave up. And then they woke up and, you know, probably tearing out their hair and yelling in anguish, because that's what WoW fans do when they don't get what they want.
Absolutely.
I'm just going to highlight a couple of the quick things, one for each class, that I just think is like the coolest updates that they're adding. Shamans are getting an ability that let them cast spells while moving for a temporary amount of time. Instant cast, 10-second duration, 2-minute cooldown. That's going to be incredible in PvP.
The Warlocks, cast spells while moving.
I'm sure you can, Dan. Warlocks are getting green fire, which is fantastic. It's kind of an inside joke in the Warlock community. They've just always wanted green fire. Just because that seems like a Warlock thing to do. And so they're finally getting Fell Flame, which lets them cast Green Fire. Priests are getting Leap of Faith, which is basically the equivalent of Death Knight's Death Grip that lets the priest grab a friendly party member wherever and pull them over to them, like a Mortal Kombat, get over here. And so...
Except a friendly one.
Yes, a friendly one. Like, more like, hey, get over here, buddy.
Please come over here.
Please come over here. Please stand by my side.
It's like when your grandma comes at you to give you a kiss, you know? You're like kind of, you're leaning backwards. You're like, no.
Running away.
And then her arms get longer and longer and longer. And then she pulls you toward her.
And then Logan wakes up and his bed is wet.
Yes. But it's very pleasant when you wet. So I remember like when I wet myself when I was a kid, like you'd wake up and you'd be like, oh, it's so warm. And then you'd realize what's happening.
The slow realization.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That kind of memory sticks with you, actually, Logan.
Yeah.
Yes. More of a nightmare than a dream, really. And then, of course, Warrior, which is my personal favorite class of the moment, is getting Heroic Leap, which is fantastic. It's just what I picture from all the movies where, like, the warrior just, like, leaps off a cliff, slams down, and stuns everyone around him and just lets out a crazy war cry. So, yeah, if you're interested, go to MMOChampion.com, or you can track it down on the Blizzard forums. But they'll be coming out, three more coming out tomorrow, and then Paladin sometime in, like, a week. Poor Paladins. They always get forgotten. All right. Enough Blizzard stuff, because I know some of you don't like Blizzard, and that's okay. So let's, actually, this week, Evan and Logan got to see some pretty exciting stuff. You guys want to tell us about it?
It was like being strapped into a chair and having two giant syringes filled with awesome jammed into your eyes and then plunged.
And that's actually exactly what happened.
Yeah, plunged in, down a roller coaster addition to that. That's what the chair's for. Yeah. Yeah. So we were in,
let's hope you didn't oversell anything.
Logan and I were in New York City, the city of cities, to see Crysis 2. First real like gameplay demonstration of Crysis 2 that's ever been shown to the world. And, you know, I guess they thought they'd show it in NYC because the game is set in NYC and that's a big deal now, you know, going from the jungle to the urban environment. Got to talk to Savat Yearly, the president and CEO of Crytek.
Yeah.
That's his title. He's the ringleader.
He's
the ringleader of Crytek. Just brilliant guy. Great to talk to. And
Crybaby. I wonder if they should call themselves Crybabies. So if you work at Crytek, you're a Crybaby.
That's pretty good.
If your kid is born while they're working on a game at Crytek. Because that's what they do. Have you guys finished, sorry to go on this tangent, but have you finished the Monkey Island game? In the credits, they have the monkey babies.
Oh, yeah.
Carry on. Sorry.
That's adorable. So back to, you know, men and action and aliens invading the world.
Babies.
No. So by the time you're hearing this podcast, if you head on over to sosnewyork.com, you should be able to see the teaser trailer that we saw there. But what you won't be able to see is the gameplay demo we saw. And yeah, Logan, what's the most exciting or interesting thing out of that, you think?
There's kind of two parts for me. One is just how awesome it is to play Crysis in the city, in an urban environment, you know, because it's really the way, you know, Manhattan, and we don't know exactly why yet. We can make some inferences, but Manhattan has been decimated. There are no people there. Everything's blown out. I mean, no civilians there. Buildings are wrecked. Everything looks like hell. And yet it still has this, sort of amazingly traversable feel because parts of buildings have been gouged out. You know, you can still go up inside them like you would maybe climb a tree and then jump down from several stories high. Sort of like you did in Prototype. And so there's this idea that you're in what is almost literally an urban jungle, you know, because you have the same sort of jungle tactics that you used in the original Crysis, where you were always taking cover in the brush and all that. But now you just do it in an urban setting where you have road dividers. You can, you know, crouch behind cars.
That actually does get me pretty excited about it, because my favorite parts of Crysis were the areas that were not, you know, urban, but they actually had man-made structures there. There was stuff to blow up besides trees.
Yeah.
There was stuff to take cover behind that wasn't really narrow. You know, I just find those areas more interesting to fight in.
Yeah. And on top of that, it's not only just urban, but it's also sort of New York and, you know, I'd say about 20 years into the future. You know, so, you know, it looks a little more techie, a little more shiny and metallic.
Techno pigeons.
Exactly. Techno pigeon with their little techno poops. But the other aspect is just the enhanced AI and the new combat, which the AI's definitely got a huge boot in the butt. And we, you know, we saw a new configuration of the aliens, which was much more, tactically minded.
Yeah.
And smarter, much more aggressive, and kind of like meaner.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the AI? Because I mean, that was kind of a point of contention among a lot of people. I mean, for me, like the AI of the Korean soldiers in the first one was really good most of the time. I mean, sometimes it would go nuts and like jump off a cliff and go swimming until it died. But the way it flanked you, yeah. It did all kinds of really interesting stuff that I thought it was one of the more compelling AIs I've ever played against.
Yeah. This is all based on live gameplay that we saw, you know, so it wasn't necessarily scripted, and it certainly wasn't pre-rendered or anything like that. But we saw things like, you know, you've got a grenade launcher and, you know, the alien's not just going to stand still and wait for it to roll between its legs and go boom, you know, it dodges, it takes cover. It uses cover smartly, but then when the moment of engagement comes, when it knows it's got a moment, one alien came rushing at us and began to actually circle strafe the guy who was controlling, who was at the controls, making it very, very difficult to track because he was in so tight, and just nailing us, you know, left and right before taking cover again behind a car. And I just thought it was just so tense because you know, it's so hard to keep up with somebody who's circling you when they're that close in.
Yeah. I think just to jump back to what you're saying about the sort of the personality of the creatures, that they seem meaner. I remember them. This was sort of a scripted sequence. A helicopter came through and dropped down some drop pods that had these, I think had those creatures in them. And again, like just to sort of describe them, I think they're sort of like probably 10 or 11 feet tall, you know, bipedal. I'm trying to think, like, they almost had like some sort of like dreadlocks behind them or something, like sort of tentacle looking.
And they may have had like, you know, they had their own armor, you know, kind of almost their own nano suit in a sense, but with other abilities.
They definitely have like a carapace and like some sort of rifle. And they're just
nice use of carapace.
Thanks.
Nice. Everybody, come on.
We were all thinking it. Logan was just saying it.
Hey, I'm just saying, when was the last time you heard the word carapace used and you're like, oh, that was a poor use of carapace?
Well, I never know how to like pronounce it. I always read it and I'm like, carapace?
I'm just saying every use of the word carapace is a nice use of the
okay,
word carapace.
Okay, all right, I'll buy that. Please.
By definition.
So anyway, we were, you know, in a scripted sequence. It's sort of an in-game cinematic. Our character got thrown into a helicopter. He's actually being captured by... Oh, what's the corporation called? The Cry Suits Corporation in the game.
Oh,
Cry something.
Hasbro.
Yeah, the people that made the Cry suit. And we're in the helicopter. Of course, gets shot down, and you know your character sort of face down in the street, recovering his energy. You can hear like the AI talking about the systems coming back online and energy being diverted, and these. You're seeing the aliens fight the people you're just captured by. And, you know, just to make sure they kill them after the aliens shoot their rifles at them, they sort of walk forward.
Oh, yeah.
And they all simultaneously, while the other humans are sort of face down the street, just pound like two more clips into them for the hell of it.
That was gross. Wow. Yeah.
It's like, okay, this is the kind of people things you're fighting against. And,
they seem less feral than the aliens at the end of Crisis.
Yeah, they're a little more systematic, menacing,
and sophisticated.
Yeah, they had cigarettes with filters. I guess I always kind of give more value to AI and enemies that are a little more expressive or like entertaining over outright just smart. And I think for me, within the context of that demonstration, they really demonstrated that too. When there was a point later on where we had this grenade launcher, and again, it's had like a huge splash effect, but like long fuses, I guess, like the grenades took a long time to explode. So you have to really like plant them well and maybe try to corner enemies with them. But we, you know, we put a grenade right into an enemy, and its shell was almost, I'm trying to imagine, remember the shape. It was sort of like the circular, part of its armor, the spherical part of its armor in the chest, kind of like eggshelled open. And you could sort of see the inside of the enemy itself, like the sort of meaty, fleshy bits as it fell backward. And,
just for the sake of this podcast, can we refer to that spherical middle bit as the carapace?
Absolutely, please. Chewy
inside, yeah, that's fine.
I insist,
of course. But you know, they don't speak English. Like you said, like within it was probably like a 15-minute demo. We really got a sense of these enemies as being challenging and scary, and like, okay, we have to use our powers to get through these guys. That's the only thing that's keeping us alive, and it was thrilling. Yeah.
So would you say that Crysis 2 is more than, you know, kind of like more Crysis, more of the first game, or are they trying to actually do something new and interesting with it and, you know, take a non-lazy approach towards it?
I mean, we definitely need to see more situations to really judge that. I think we're hoping most of all that it's, they kind of keep saying this, that it's, you know, it's a more vertical game with the cities and the rooftops in there. Dan, you were mentioning that you really like the moments in Crysis 1 with structures. And, you know, if there's enough of that regular, like, leaping and bounding, and I guess, like, the other big question is, how is the sandbox going to work in a city environment? Is it going to be as much of a sandbox? Is it going to degrade over time? Are you going to revisit landmarks? Just what does that look like, I guess?
Well, you know, sandboxing in a big city is, you know, it's hardly a new thing. I mean, if you look at GTA, or even like Just Cause 2 has, you know, small cities in there, has actually a wide variety of environments built into one big world. So, and it's certainly possible to do, and they have a lot of inspiration to draw from in that respect.
I agree. And this might sound strange, but I think it is a really different prospect in first person when you're not seeing your character leaping and bounding over these things and navigating the environment in that way. It's a harder thing to do. You know, movement is a different matter, and I'm really hoping they can make it fun and interesting and platformy in a good way. So
when we talked to Chavat yearly after the demo, really I loved hearing him describe the game. It was it was really beautiful, actually, to hear him describe it, because he talks about how their approach. When I asked him, you know, how did they I was asking technical questions about how they captured New York City. And he's like, what we wanted is to capture the idea of New York City, which is the sort of city of all cities, like Evan said earlier, you know, and it's got a very sentimental value to not just Americans, but for the whole world. You know, it's kind of like this apex of civilization. And now it's been destroyed, and it's up to you to protect it and to do what you can to beat back the aliens from, I don't know if they're making it their new readout, you know, or whatever. But he described the look of Manhattan in Crysis 2 as catastrophic beauty, you know, the beauty of a city that's been destroyed and is now being sort of overtaken by nature again. And that's the arena in which your battles take place. And it really did look like that. It had catastrophic beauty everywhere. Everywhere you turned were these gorgeous buildings, you know, but they've been hammered, and nature is sort of crawling back in through every crevice.
I just made some catastrophic beauty in my pants.
Nice.
Wait, I don't even know what that means.
Lower the dialogue.
I have no idea what that means, but I'm proud of it.
So, am I interrupting you, Logan? I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Cool. So not to shift subjects, because I totally agree. Shabbat was a beautifully interesting guy to talk to. Really enjoyed it. The one like hard information stuff we should mention, they were talking about how they had their new writer up there. I forget his name. But he's a guy that's produced some sci-fi fiction and novels. But they're talking about the nanosuit. I'm sorry. I was referring to it as the cry suit before. I don't know where I got that from, but they're talking about the nanosuit having its own narrative within the game, and sort of acting as a character a little bit. And they said that will include upgrades in some form. And we asked them about this, and, you know, is that going to include attachments? Because that's, you know, something like rocket launcher backpacks, or like wrist add-ons or something like that, or, you know, so eye goggles.
You want to turn him into Boba Fett.
Something like that. And they sort of, you know, took us in a different direction and said that it's probably more going to be more along the lines of parameters. There's going to be some sort of currency that you have to invest in, you know, say having more energy in, you know, super strength or super speed or stealth. So maybe you're having a better buffer within those abilities that you can choose to develop if you're more of a stealth player, or, you know, a high jumping player or something like that. So that's probably the form it'll take. We're thinking right now.
Yeah, that does add some interesting depth. I mean, to be able to bump up my stealth so that, like, maybe it costs less energy to punch somebody while stealthed, what was it that burned a lot of, like, what it was when you fire while stealthed, if you don't de-stealth first, it just drains all of your energy, leaving you, like, really vulnerable. So yeah. if you could get an upgrade that would make it so that you could fire while stealthed, or, you know, fire and thus decloak yourself and not burn all your energy, that would be a huge upgrade.
Yeah. Or if you could, like, throw your weapon's voice like a ventriloquist, so it sounds like you're firing from over there.
Right.
That would be an awesome upgrade.
Yeah. And I guess just, sorry, Logan. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Just as a, I don't know if it's a closing note or not, but we did see the game on console and you have really nothing to be afraid about of Crysis 2 becoming a multi-platform game or, you know, going on the console. It's as much as, you know, it looked fine. It was, you know, serviceable and good looking on console, I guess, but it's a PC game fundamentally. It's built on the PC. It starts in the PC, and that engine excels wonderfully on the PC. There's a lot of aliasing in some of the footage we saw on console that kind of caught us off guard, but, you know, there's no reason to switch platforms to play Crysis.
Quick kind of lore question, I guess. So has New York City been evacuated? There's no citizens in the city anymore?
They didn't say, and probably aren't going to say for a while, but the impression I get is that it did look to me like it had been evacuated, yes, after an initial attack.
Oh, okay, cool.
Because otherwise, you know, you see them sprinkled everywhere like, you know, salt and pepper.
Are the New York pizzas safe?
No. And that's why you're there.
Save their delicious crust.
What I was going to say earlier was basically just what Evan said, which is, you know, I'd seen a tech demo a while back, and I was blown away by what Crytek managed to do with the console engines, PS3 and Xbox. And I saw the engine working on both. I was just stunned at how much you could wring out of this hardware. But when we saw the game today, we saw footage, I believe from PC and PS3. I'm not sure about Xbox. But this time, yeah, there's just no comparison. There are just things that Crysis 2 is a game to be played on the PC. This is not an anti-console rant by any stretch of the imagination. But it is, after seeing what we saw, at this demo, the PC is the only way to play it.
And I saw some of the early, you know, CryEngine stuff, or CryEngine 2 stuff it's CryEngine 3 now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw some of those videos online and they looked really good, you know, running on the console, except those, you know, most of those videos you see are pretty small.
Yeah. So, and so the thing is, we saw like it on a huge screen and suddenly you're like, oh.
Yeah.
Okay. And the thing is it's not that it looks bad. It doesn't. It looks fantastic. But we are used to Crysis, right? Yeah. We've played Crysis and Crysis Warhead and Crysis Wars. And you look at it and you're like, oh God, that's, it just looks like such a huge step back. Even from Crysis, Warhead, which, as we all know, you know, the system requirements, they did a great job on sort of pushing them back down. But then to see it on a big screen, you know, with a console engine trying to, you know, huff and puff all this stuff out. Ooh, not always a pretty tight. But again, for a console thing, it did look fantastic, I have to admit.
So it looks like we got time for one reader question. So Andy, pick the best question we have.
Ooh. Make it good.
Pressure's on.
Pick the worst.
Well, what's up, PC gamers? Daryl calling. Six
hey,
cores,
Daryl.
Dan? Man, you must not have any kids. Anyway, that's not the reason I'm calling. Hey, just checking on with you guys to see if Crysis 2, when it's coming out, and have you guys got the requirements on that? Because I'm trying to wait for that to see how I'm going to upgrade my computer. Thanks. Love the podcast.
I do not have any kids.
think of the biggest graphics card number you can think of. Now multiply it by 4.
Now that is a pretty good question, actually. I mean, I wonder how much Crytek learned from the first crisis, you know, with kind of all the negative connotations that crisis acquired.
I think they learned a lot.
Yeah, and with Warhead, it was substantially decreased. With the CryEngine 2 or 3, sorry, I always get confused because it's Crysis 2 on CryEngine 3. But I mean, with CryEngine 3, one of their big things was, oh, it's gonna run well on console hardware. So I mean, they've got to bring requirements down just for that, right?
Absolutely. I mean, here, this is my projection, which is that, like I said earlier, the Crysis 2. And the console footage we saw looked fantastic. Make no mistake about it. And it boggles my mind that they're doing this on hardware that's how many years old now, you know? And that wasn't even that state of the art when it came out. And the thing is all it needed was higher resolution textures a little bit, and that little extra post-processing that you can do on the PC, the higher anti-aliasing, and, you know, and stuff like that. So I think that the requirements will surprise everybody and how reasonable they are. However, if you want the, you know, the absolute most brilliant image imaginable on a 30-inch screen, then of course you will need, you know, a pretty powerful video card. But I think it'll scale down very, very, very well. Because if you played on a PC that was the equivalent of console hardware, and you saw what we saw at this demo, you'd still be pretty pleased and you'd have a great time.
Do we know what the release date is like at this point?
Holiday 2010.
So with that, let's get to playlists. Dan, what have you been playing?
Oh, some Just Cause 2, mostly. I've just been running around there causing havoc whenever I get a few minutes. I actually just got done, just a couple nights ago, I played an episode of, or not, sorry, an episode, a match of Total Annihilation with Chris Taylor, which was a lot of fun, because neither of us had played it in about 5 years. And jumping back into that game, which is really complex without any warm up, without going back, even after you've played a bunch of SEPCOM, which, you know, has a lot of things in common with it, going back to Total Annihilation, is really kind of a shock to the system, and just trying to relearn all of the intricacies of that. And I'm writing up a story about that for our next issue. It was a lot of fun. Did anybody here play Total Annihilation?
No, but I like the soundtrack.
The soundtrack is brilliant. Unfortunately, it's available on the game is available on Impulse, but unfortunately, like the version of Jedi Knight on Steam, because all the music was like on the disc, and the game is looking for the disc to find the music, you don't get the music with the game you buy off of Impulse, which is damn disappointing because it's a really awesome Jeremy Soule soundtrack. You can actually go onto YouTube and listen to the whole thing. Just search for Total Annihilation music.
Logan, what are you playing?
I hurt my shoulder, as everybody knows, and spent part of last week at home nursing it. And I replayed Prey, and I feel like, wow, that was so much fun. I wonder if it was underrated.
What did we rate it?
Well, I can't remember.
I remember because I rated it.
What did you rate it?
I gave it an 82.
I just had such a great time. I'm wondering if it didn't deserve an 82.4. You know, because I had a blast and it didn't even like make me want to barf, which a lot of games do. But yeah, I had a blast from start to finish. It was certainly a great way to pass along a day when you're otherwise howling in pain.
What did you think of Obi-Wan Kimosabi?
Who? What?
the grandfather character who's like the ghost.
Oh, who does a good impression of him? Hello, sir. That was, yeah. I'm just kind of glad he got the shaft in the chest because I got tired of listening to him. But, spoiler alert!
What did you think of the story, by the way?
I liked the story.
You know, it wasn't bad. It wasn't maudlin. And you had a nice, believable, you know, central character.
Do you know who wrote that story?
No, who wrote that story?
That was Gary Whitta.
Get out.
No, that was him.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yep.
Holy free holy. No spoilers. Anyway, I heartily recommend it. Now I'm playing a bunch of, what do you know, GOG games, GOG. Sanitarium came out, and so I'm playing that again, as well as Another World, which is in an upcoming game club, coming to a game club near you.
Yeah, I think they should re-release Prey from the author of Book of Eli on it.
Oh, yeah.
Eric, what are you playing?
A Little Settlers 7. Still having fun with that.
I'm still finding putting flags on your castles.
It has that Ubisoft you play thing where you can earn points for playing, and there are unlockable flags for your castle. So, you know, excitement abounds there.
Have you had any issues with the DRM? Because I've been hearing like the servers go down sometimes. See, and
I was just going to comment on that because I've read like horror stories on the forums, and I have yet to have a single issue. With the exception of the time we tried to play and we couldn't connect for some reason. Yeah. I've been able to play every time I've wanted to play.
Who's your ISP?
Comcast. I'm with Comcast. So yeah, I don't know. My heart goes out to the people with all the troubles playing it, because it's a really fantastic game. I'm having a lot of fun with it. So close to hitting 40 in World of Warcraft. I'll try to do that this weekend, because then you get, you know, as WoW players know, you get the good mount, and you can finally kind of cruise around efficiently. That's kind of my plans. I'm looking forward to Splinter Cell Conviction, but I guess that's not out for 2 weeks on the PC or whatever. So yeah,
one thing that Settlers 7 does that I think is really cool is their mentor system. Have you been doing that a lot, Eric?
Oh yeah. Which is, for those that don't know, which is probably most of you, Settlers 7.
An elderly Native American goes, "Well, what you need to do?" Sorry.
Sort of like that, except you can choose to be the elderly Native American. When you create an account, you can check a box that says, "Yes, I would like to mentor other players." And so if you're familiar with Settlers, or if you're lucky enough like me to have had Bruce Shelley walk you through the entire game, players who are going into the game and having trouble understanding some mechanic can just click a button and look for a mentor. And it kind of shoots a question around to the mentors, and you can select, yes, I know how to respond to this, or no, I don't, and it'll go to a different mentor. And you can kind of help new players understand the game better. It's a really cool system. I probably... When I'm playing, I get two or three messages per game. Just people wondering, new players wondering how certain mechanics work or how they get to certain buildings and stuff.
Do you ever just take a page from a Dota helper book and tell them to stop playing and die?
I would, but I need more people to play Settlers with. I can't always reliably find a multiplayer match, so I try to get as many people in enjoying the game as possible.
So stop playing and go kill yourself.
I have had people ask, like, why did you put the DRM in this game? And, lols, you guys are lame at Ubisoft. But
they think you work for Ubisoft?
Yeah, they don't quite get it. But all in all, I mean, that's a really cool system. I can't really think of other games that have done something like that.
So wait a minute, they got in there to make fun of Ubisoft for putting the DRM after they bought it?
Yeah, it appears so.
Okay.
No one said these people were smart, Dan.
Well, people playing the demo can also connect to mentors.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
So yeah, there you go.
I mean, I guess there are probably some people out there that would buy it without realizing the DRM on there, even though it's got the giant thing on the box saying internet connection required. Well, there's probably somebody out there who bought it. So I won't say that people are stupid for asking that question or for making that comment.
I don't know how many times I've gone to the grocery store and bought something, and then later on when I got home, you know, the box says, you know, clearly contains poison, you know, and I just, you know, I just ask it anyway, you know.
Or like that 3D toothpaste you're talking about.
or like, You bought some Easy Mac? Is that?
This has gone too far. This whole 3D craze. I was getting some toothpaste at the grocery store, and I think it's Colgate or somebody has now 3D whitening flavor. It says nothing else on the box other than, you know, whitening power of Colgate, you know, but it was 3D whitening.
Well, that's a junior genius. Like red and blue anaglyphs, so when you put on the glasses, they pop out.
That would be hilarious. But the D must stand for something else in that particular situation.
Dumbass.
Like 3 out of 5 dentists.
What if it came with like 3D glasses and like while you brushed your teeth, it like projected 3D images from your mouth? I'd buy that toothpaste. If it like projected little like alien spaceships to keep you entertained while you brush your teeth and like it lasts 2 minutes so you know how long.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely want my teeth to appear in 3D to other people, because then I can like, you know, pretend to bite people from like 10 feet away and they'll go like, ah!
Awesome.
The possibilities are endless. All right. So Evan, have you been playing any 3D toothbrushing games?
Unfortunately, no. What I have been playing, so Logan and I were flying on Delta on the way back, and they happen to have that wacky futuristic internet on planes thing. So you can
unheard of.
Yeah, world of tomorrow.
Yeah. It was really exciting. For a number of reasons. But I immediately tried some Flash games, and my netbook wasn't keeping pace with all of them. I was playing Crush the Castle a little bit, and it didn't like the physics in there. But what did work really well was TetrisFriends.com, which is, you know, a game that was featured in our top 100 games of all time on the PC. And just playing 6-player Tetris with people, you know, 30,000 feet in the air, just hanging out, beating some French people at Tetris. It's pretty good. Pretty
USA,
terrific.
USA. USA.
They're not friends anymore.
And now that I'm home, I'll be playing a little bit more Mountain Blade Warband. I'm discovering, you know, there were theories about this when mankind discovered the steak gun and Painkiller, but parabolas, you know, parabolic bullets, basically, you know, shooting weapons that fire bullets in like a parabolic path,
mm-hmm.
make for the best weapons, I think. You know, crossbowing people out of midair and like just wiring this impossible shot sort of while you're strafing over a shoulder or something.
I believe you're onto something there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've made a discovery, and it's.
Wait, why? I'm not clear on that. Why is a parabolic path better than, you know, a straight A to B when I want an accurate shot?
It just rubs a pleasure center. Yeah.
There's that amazing feeling of uncertainty, right? Because, like, with distance especially, you're not quite sure how much it's going to drop.
You master like an invisible metric, you know.
But would it be possible then to have other people's weapons be inaccurate while mine remains accurate? Because that would be more rewarding.
Can you cut his mic? I've had just about enough of that.
I know, you already threatened to cut my mic, Logan. I mean, if we keep doing this, it's just going to be you on here. Maybe that's what you want, but
what's wrong with that?
Yeah. All right, fine. We'll have a PC Logan podcast next time.
All furry woodland creatures all the time.
Just gonna be like chirping and chipping the whole time. Before this gets too out of hand, I'm gonna step in and take over. I've kind of talked about before, I've just been playing Dragon Age. I've been on a quest to play the perfect Dragon Age game. So I'm going through. Eric did a terrible, terrible thing and showed me Dragon Age Journeys, which I don't know how I didn't know about this. It's a web-based game that's like, I don't know. Apparently it's like 10 or 11 hours, but it's turn-based combat. And it's basically like a mini version of Dragon Age. Like I started a dwarf commoner and like ended up in the deep roads and I'm having to fight my way out. Oh, it's blowing my mind. It's so good. And best of all, you know, it unlocks items in the game that you can use. So my perfect Dragon Age game, is still ahead of me. So yeah, I've just been playing that a bunch and doing WoW Arena with my warrior, which has been fantastic. And Andy Bauman.
I haven't really been playing much Bad Company 2, but that's about it for me.
What's new in the Bad Company 2 scene these days?
Nothing.
Company's still bad.
Company? Bad. M60 overpowered. That's about it.
Yeah. M60 is a point machine, man. Yeah.
Like, if I were to run in and play Bad Company 2 right now, what should I do? What's the most fun to do right now?
You better not play with me, because I'll just own you.
Fair enough.
Just kidding. I'm a little rusty, I think. I haven't played in a couple days. I don't know. The best thing to do is jump on the Ventrilo server and hook up with some people and find a server if there's no game on the PC Gamer. War Bagel or Croissant or Scone, for that matter.
Thank you, Andy.
You're welcome. And then go find a game and just start playing with some folks. It's all fun all the time, no matter what you do. Even if you're losing, at least it looks cool and sounds good.
So I think that about wraps us up for today. And of course, don't forget that we want to make you famous and to speak your mind about any and everything game related. So send your MP3 question, comment, or rage-fueled rant to pcgamerpodcast@gmail.com, or just call us toll-free at 877-404-1337, extension 724, and record your question there. If Logan and Evan got you as excited about Crysis 2 as we are, be sure to subscribe to the magazine for a full preview and an upcoming issue, and just head over to pcgamer.com and fill out our fancy subscription form. And on behalf of all of us here at PC Gamer, thanks for listening to the podcast, and I hope you hated it. Thank you.
Who authorized anyone to get water?
Dan's gone rogue.
And that's where you'll put the interview.
Hooray!
There it goes. Look at it go.
That right. was a fantastic interview.
So authentic and believable.
That's like my biggest pet peeve on podcasts, is when clearly no one listened to what they were talking about, but they try to pull it off like they did.
Right.
All right.
Do we want to talk about the cat with wings at all, or is that maybe for a next podcast?
Do we?
Save it for playlist, Logan.
All right.
Or do you want to actually talk about that game? Or do you just want to talk about there's a cat with wings?
All I wanted to do was just say cat with wings, and I've done my part on the podcast.
So mission accomplished.
So I'll add some.
I don't care where it goes from here.
Russian developer named Akella is in charge of it now. It's basically a...
Hold on one sec.
Wait, yeah, really, we're getting a lot of noise.
You know what it was? Sorry, I just realized what it was. It was my old man's heating pad that I've got on my back. The control was sitting on the headphone wire.
Oh, my word.
And I was like, where's the interference coming from? You know?
Yeah, there it is.
I'll add a little bit of context to this. We saw a game called Disciples 3 Renaissance at GDC. You may have heard of Disciples 2. It came out several years ago. There's a Russian developer named Akella that's developing now, and it's kind of like a Heroes of Might and Magic style game, you know, grid-based roaming RPG. And we got a gig of concept art over and sketches from them this morning. Just, you know, concept art of basically every character in the game, dragons and stuff. I'm sort of pouring through it, you know, deciding what we're going to run in the magazine, and I'm like, oh my god, I just stumble onto this magnificent piece of art that
I know
is going to knock Logan out of his pants, basically. And so the way
I still don't have my boxers back on, you know?
So it's like this elven woman, she's like sitting in a forest, you know, probably a mage or something, not looking very magnificent or anything, and she sort of has her hand extended, so I'm like, you know, hey Logan, check out this, you know, this interesting character, it's a girl in a game. Oh, and he's like, okay. And I sort of zoom out further and further and further. And he sees this wing. It's this gray wing. He's like, oh, what's that? And it's like a domestic house cat with wings just flying. It's a domestic kitten for no good reason. Like a normal, like, kind of gray calico, you know?
Yeah. Domestic short hair, I believe, is the...
You know what kills me, though, is that there is... If you subscribe to the multiverse theory, and many, you know, physicists do... There is a world out there where cats have wings. Somewhere there's a universe where that's just like, of course.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. There's also a universe with no cats, Logan.
Whatever.
You know what you're talking about. Cut his mic. Yeah, that was awesome. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I'm glad. Glad to help.
Thanks
out.
For living it with me again.
No, I mean we're always happy to enable your addiction to woodland creatures and flying mammals.
And Dan would like me to talk a little softer, but I saw it after I finished.
No, sorry. Yeah,
he just seemed to be a little bit louder than everyone else, and like
I just
out.
Get excited sometimes.
Well, nice. See, that was too loud.
That was awesome.